Today we have our brother Jim Cowie. His theme for the week is events subsequent to the return of Christ. And his subject for today is there shall be a resurrection of the dead, just and unjust.
Thanks once again. Good morning, young people.
Good morning.
Thank you. Okay, well, yesterday we very quickly took you through an overview of the events subsequent to the return of Christ. We called it the March of the Rainbowed Angel. And this morning we're going to step back. We're going to go back to the beginning, to the return of Christ, and to the first thing that he will do. When he comes, the very first thing, as we saw in 1 Thessalonians chapter 4, is that he will raise the dead. And they will know that Christ is in the earth before we know. But of course, this raises the question, young people, of who will be raised. I want you to turn to the 1st of Peter, chapter 4. We'll be talking about this for a few minutes. Now, this chapter is very important to us because it speaks about the question of responsibility to divine judgment. It tells us very plainly in verse 17 of the 1st of Peter 4, "For the time is come that judgment must begin at the house of God. Never let anyone tell you that the saints are not judged until after Christ has established his power in Jerusalem." It's wrong. Judgment must begin at the house of God. It begins with those who are responsible to divine judgment. Christ is not going to come and start dealing with the nations before he judges the saints. That's the first thing he does. He judges his household. To make that very clear in your mind. Some people are confused about that. And so we need to understand that the very first thing that Christ does is to raise the dead, and he will raise those who are responsible for the purpose of judgment. Now, this is how Peter explains in this context this question of responsibility to divine judgment. I want to talk just a moment about the parameters of this. As far as God is concerned, there are two classes of mankind. There are those called saints, and there are those called sinners. But each of those classes has groups beneath them. There are righteous saints, and there are ungodly saints. That is, people who do not live in accordance with the truth. Amongst sinners, there are enlightened sinners and there are unenlightened sinners. Now, of course, the great bulk of mankind fits into this group here. There's a vast number of people in our world who have absolutely no idea about what God requires of them. They do not turn to the Bible. They have no appreciation. They have no responsibility. They don't know the truth. So the bulk of them fit in here. But you and I, young people, will fit somewhere in these three groups. In the day of judgment, we will come somewhere in those three. We want to talk about this. We want to see what Peter says about it. He goes on to say, there in verse 17, he says, "For the time has come. The judgment must begin at the house of God. And if it first begin at us, what shall the end be of them that obey not the gospel of God?" And then he says in verse 18, "And if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear?" Now in verse 18, he has those three groups that we've been talking about. We're not talking about the unenlightened here. We're talking about these three. Okay? And Peter describes each one of those in verse 18 of chapter 4 of his first epistle. He says, if the righteous scarcely be saved, where shall the ungodly and the sinner appear? So the righteous and the ungodly saints are responsible to divine judgment because they have a covenant relationship and they are responsible for the outcomes of that relationship with their God. Now, you know what responsibility is, don't you? If I make you responsible for something, what am I asking you to do? Come on, you can give me some feedback. If I make you responsible for a duty, what am I actually asking you to do? Yes, you're responsible to make sure it happens. And I'm going to ask you, if it doesn't happen, why it didn't happen, okay? I'm going to ask you to explain to me that when I gave you a responsibility and you said, yes, I accept that responsibility and it doesn't happen, I want to know why it didn't happen. I want to know the reasons why you failed. Or in the case of success, if you have fulfilled it, I will commend you and say, you've done very well. Well done, thou good and faithful servant. They're the words the Lord Jesus Christ will use at the judgment seat. Okay, so we have our two groups, in the righteous and the ungodly, who sit under this class of people, saints. People who have made a covenant with God by baptism, who have accepted the responsibilities of the truth. When they come to the judgment seat, young people, Christ is going to want to know what they did with the deposit that he gave them, the responsibilities of his truth. He will want to know the outcomes. He has a right to do that. But they're not the only ones who are going to be there. This group over here, the enlightened sinners, are also amenable to divine judgment. And they're the ones that Peter mentions at the end of verse 18. He says, if the righteous are scarcely saved, and what he means by that is that it's going to take an enormous outpouring of divine mercy to save any one of us. If the righteous, who've done the right thing, will have to have poured upon them the grace and the mercy of God to be saved, where will the ungodly, these people, saints, where will they appear? And the sinner, where will they appear? He's talking here about enlightened sinners who will be held accountable. They haven't accepted the responsibilities of the truth, but they knew what it required of them. These are people who had time and opportunity. Now, in your case, young people, you're very young. Many of you are quite young. You are just going through the stage of life where you're beginning to realise what the truth is all about. Some of you may well have made that commitment. And you're in a position where you're sorting your lives out. God knows exactly where you stand in the scheme of things, and he knows whether or not you are delaying accepting the responsibilities of the truth. And there are some people who do that. They sort of say in themselves, well, look, you know, I'd love to have time to do this and to do that or to do something else. And I'll just put off baptism. I know what it requires of me, but I'll just put it off until I'm ready. Well, if Christ comes while you're putting it off, you may have some serious issues to face. If you know what's right, and you know what you should do, if you have been enlightened by the truth, you need to take action. It's as simple as that. Now, I know that this is a difficult situation in some people's lives because of the circumstances they may be in. I know that some people develop later than others. I happen to have a family. I happen to have raised children. But God knows whether or not we are responsible or accountable to his judgment. Now, why do you think I've used a different word here? Accountability rather than responsibility. There's not a great deal of difference between those words in the English language, but there is a difference. And the difference is this, that at the judgment seat of Christ, those people who have been enlightened by the truth, who have come to a realization of what it requires of them, and yet turn their back upon it, do not accept its responsibilities. They will be there at the judgment seat of Christ. He's not going to ask them what they did with the deposit of the truth that he gave them and which they accepted, because they didn't accept it. But he is going to ask them why they refused to accept it. He's going to ask them to explain why they didn't accept responsibility. They will be held accountable. So all of us who have some relationship to the truth, who are learning what it requires of us, are confronted by this fact. We are going to be somewhere in that group of people. We can't claim to be these. The unenlightened, the vast majority of mankind who are not accountable, they're in ignorance. But we can claim to be in these. It's a question of where we end up in that scheme of things. Well, I think most of us, if we had a choice, would probably like to end up here, right? In that one? Well, we can. Because God's grace and his mercy is extended to us that we might find life in that day. So that's a very important issue, young people, in relation to your future. And all of us, one day, will have our destinies determined by the choices that we have made, the path that we choose, and the responsibilities that we accept and fulfil, or fail to fulfil. That will determine our destiny. Now, this morning, I want to talk about resurrection. I want you to come now to the 1st of Corinthians. No, just a second. We won't leave 1 Peter for a while. I've got one more thing I want to say before we leave. We are going to talk about resurrection. The word in the New Testament for resurrection is this word anastasis. Others say it differently, but that's how I say it. It means a rising up, a standing up from the root anastemi, to stand or to cause to rise. That word is used 42 times in the New Testament. It is translated 39 times as resurrection, once as rising again, once raised to life again, and once that should rise. It's the same word, anastasis. It means the standing up of dead ones, as we're going to see when we come to 1 Corinthians 15. Resurrection of the dead will be a virtual recreation of former beings into exactly the same mental, moral and physical state that they possessed prior to their death. Now, some of the Corinthian brethren had problem with this. Because of the philosophical turn of mind of the Greeks, they had a real problem as to how God, or how anyone for that matter, how you could raise a dead body that had moulded into dust and dissipated. How you could raise a person and recreate them into the identical person that they were before they died. Give them back all their physical features, you know, all the hairs of their head. In my case, it's not many. Give them back their characteristics, their personality, and all the things that make up a person, an individual. How is that possible? Well, it has to be a recreation. And every single detail of our being is in the mind of God. He knows every detail. He hasn't forgotten and he will never forget it. So he will raise people in the exact mental, moral and physical state that they once existed in before their death. And there are thousands, yea, millions of people to be raised. So it's an act of God that brings us about. That's why you see Peter says here in the 1st of Peter 4 in verse 19. He says, "Wherefore let them that suffer according to the will of God commit the keeping of their souls to him in well-doing as unto a faithful creator." Now he could have said, couldn't he? A faithful God. He could have said a faithful father. He could have used any of the titles of God. He doesn't. He uses the title a faithful creator. Because, you see, resurrection is going to be a recreation. Now, you think about the people to whom Peter wrote this epistle. The believers in the times of AD 63 to 66, in the worst years of the reign of Nero, the violent emperor who came to the power of the Roman Empire at age 17. He lasted for 14 years. He died at the age of 31. In the last 3 years of his emperorship, he began to persecute the Christians. You know what he used to do with them, young people? Amongst other things? He would take our brethren of the first century and he would put them on poles. He would shove a pole, while they were alive, up through their body. He would dip them in tar and light them so that he could use his backyard to practice his charioteering. He would sew them up in the skins of newly killed animals and throw them to the lions and other wild beasts to be torn to shreds and eaten by wild animals. So our brethren ended up as charred ruins on a pole or in the dung of wild animals. And he's writing to them and saying, don't worry about it. Commit your souls, your lives, unto God as unto a faithful creator. He can recreate. Doesn't matter what they do to you. He can recreate. And you will come forth from the ground exactly as you were before you died. Now that's a marvellous thing. But of course it takes faith to believe that. And there will be many who will emerge from the earth, from this era of time, who did believe that and will come forth to a newness of life. Now we can come back to 1 Corinthians 15. Now many of you will be aware, and I want you to turn this up because I want you to have a look at the words on the page. 1 Corinthians chapter 15. This is a chapter about resurrection. It has been a chapter that has caused some confusion. There are a number of different interpretations about what Paul is actually trying to say here, particularly on this word sown, which we meet in 1 Corinthians 15 and at verse 36. But we'll start a bit earlier than that. We'll go back to verse 35. Because the matter of resurrection was a great concern to the Apostle Paul. There were some in the Corinthian ecclesia who did not believe that it was possible to bring forth a body from the dust of the earth and to recreate it as it had been before. So he says in verse 35, but some men will say, how are the dead raised up? And with what body do they come? In actual fact, that should be rendered, to or for what body do they come forth? That was the issue at hand. What kind of body is it that you're talking about? If you're talking about resurrection, to or for what kind of body do they come forth? That's the question. Thou fool, says Paul in verse 36, that which thou sowest is not quickened except it die. And he goes on to speak about this idea of sowing. Now in our community, as I said, there are several different views as to what this word means. Some suggest that we are sown when we are born into a state and an environment related to corruption, dishonour, weakness, and to things natural. So they're talking here about birth. That's not right. A second view is that when we are sown when the dead body is buried in the ground. That is right for verses 36 to 41. The third view is that we are sown when we are called forth from the grave at the resurrection. That is right for verses 42 to 45. I'm going to show you why. Now you might say to me, well, how can this one be right and how can that one be right? Well, it all depends on our understanding of the language that is used here in 1 Corinthians 15. We're going to see that there is a difference between the word sown or sowest, as it is used in verses 36 and 37, to that which we find in verses 42 to 44. So then, let's explore this. Let's see how we can explain this. We had a look at verse 35. The word raised in verse 35, where it says, how are the dead raised up, is the Greek word agairo. Now, agairo means to rebuild or to cause to exist. I want you to notice, young people, now this might be a little complex for some of you, but if you can tuck this away, or if you want to write some brief notes in your Bible, later on when you come to explore this for yourselves, you will see how important it is to understand the terms used here. Because if I say to you, as verse 35 says, how are the dead raised up? Your immediate thought is, well, we're talking here about resurrection. Well, yes, but this word agairo actually has the idea of not only rousing up, but rebuilding something, rebuilding it. So when we read, for instance, later on in this chapter, when it talks about we shall be raised incorruptible, it's not talking about just raising someone from the dead. It's actually talking about the end of that process of rebuilding them. You need to understand this. There is a term for raising someone from the dead, and that is anastasis. This word goes further. It means to rebuild or to cause to exist. So the question is, how are the dead rebuilt so they're caused to exist? And to or for what body do they come forth? Now then, we come to this word sowest. Thou fool, that which thou sowest is not quickened except it die. Verse 37, and that which thou sowest not that body that shall be, but bare or naked grain. It may chance of wheat or of some other grain, but God giveth it a body as it hath pleased him, and to every seed his own body. Now you can see, can't you, that he's actually talking here about farming. He's talking about sowing seed into the ground. This word that you see here, rendered sowest, three times, is the Greek word spiro. But importantly, young people, it is in the active voice. And in the active voice, spiro means to scatter seed or to sow seed. Now, an English lesson, a grammar lesson. How many voices do we have in English? No, we have two. We have an active and a passive. How many voices are there in Greek? Three. An active, a passive, and a middle. The active is where you are the doer of the action. The passive is where you are the receiver of an action. Someone does something to you. The middle voice to the Greek was where you did something to or for yourself. We don't have that in the English. I'm not going to worry about the middle voice now. We just want to focus on the active and the passive in the Greek. So here the use of the word spiro in the active voice means to scatter or to sow seed. It occurs three times, as we found in verses 36 and 37. They're all in the active voice, and this is the idea. A man going forth, planting seed into the ploughed ground. Liddell and Scott's Greek lexicon makes that clear. And Brother Thomas discovered this little point, and it's a very important one, because you cannot properly interpret this context unless you understand this principle of grammar. Because you see, what's being said here, young people, is that just like the farmer digs up the earth, and then he sows seed into it, so when someone dies, we dig up the earth and we put their dead body in it. True? That's what happens. We dig up the earth and we put their body in it, like a seed in the ground. That's what that means, that word sowest, when it's used here in verses 36 and 37. But there's a change, a significant change, when we get down to verse 42. So we'll come down to that verse. So remember, what we see here in verses 36 and 37 represents the burial of the dead body. That which thou sowest, says Paul, is bare or naked grain, like a body dead, prepared for burial, put in the earth. It may chance of wheat or of some other grain, but God gives it a body as it hath pleased him, verse 38. You know, there was a law established in Genesis chapter 1 that is inflexible. The law was this, that if you plant any kind of seed, you get exactly the same kind of product as the seed that you planted. Every seed after its kind. If you plant wheat, you get wheat. If you plant barley, you get barley. True? If you put a dead mortal body in the ground, what do you get out of it? On that rule, you get a mortal body out of the ground. You don't get an immortal body out of the ground, do you? The rule is simple. Plant wheat, you get wheat. So you can't put a human being who's died with a mortal body in the ground and then raise him and get an immortal one straight away, can you? Doesn't work that way. So you see, that's a very simple but important lesson. We have had some people who have tried to teach the doctrine of immortal emergence. That when we are raised, the judgment has already passed, and we pop out of the ground immortal. That's why you see, when you see that verse that might appear to say that, I'm just trying to find it. It's in verse, 52. Yes. In a moment, in the twinkling of an eye, at the last trump, for the trumpet shall sound, and the dead shall be raised incorruptible. See, their problem is they think the word raised there means resurrected. But that's the word egairo. It means to be rebuilt. So there's a process of rebuilding that has to go on before we can be incorruptible. So it's very important to establish this principle of verse 38. God has established a law. You do not get a different kind of plant from a seed that you've sown. You get what you sowed. So if you put a mortal body into the ground that has died, you get a mortal body out of the ground at resurrection. You don't get an immortal one. Okay, you got the idea of how important it is to understand the use of these words. Let's then come to verse 42. Verse 42 starts with this language. So also is the resurrection of the dead. That word resurrection there is anastasis. It is literally rendered, so also is the standing up of the dead ones. So now we're not talking about burying people, are we? Paul is now shifting to the next stage. He's spoken about sowing a seed in the ground. That's like burying the dead body. Now in verse 42, he comes to speak about the standing up of people who have been dead. He's in the context of the resurrection of the dead. You've got to remember that, you see. It's like all biblical interpretation, young people. If it doesn't fit the context, dismiss it. It must fit a context. That's how so many errors are made, both within and without our community. You must interpret the Bible within its context. So verse 42 establishes that very powerfully. We are in the context now of people popping out of the ground, being stood up in resurrection. So then, when you read the next sentence in verse 42, it says, it is sown in corruption, it is raised in incorruption, it is sown in dishonor, it is raised in glory, and so on. The word sown here can't refer, can it? It cannot refer to putting a dead body in the ground, because the context is about bringing people out of the ground. That's why you need to understand that the word spira in the Greek here in verses 42 to 44 is in the passive voice, where it speaks of the results of sowing, not the act of sowing, such as the active voice of verses 36 and 37. This is the outcome of your sowing. This is like the man standing in the field, and he's looking at the product, the outcome of what he's done. So this word in the Greek has, as you can see, a suffix added to it, which gives it its passive voice. It means to spring or to be born, and Liddell and Scott's Greek lexicon point that out. So when we come to interpret verses 42 to 44, we need to understand that Paul is in the context of the resurrection of the body. He's talking about bodies springing forth out of the ground, such as you see when you have planted seed.